I was on Twitter and everyone was like, Capital's like, what is happening?
Keep up to date with the latest WSL action and the biggest interviews.
It's just a measure of how their season has been going. They can't catch a break no matter how hard they're trying.
Subscribe to the Koi Gig podcast stream on the OTB Sports app now.
OTB AM. With Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
Very good morning. 4 days before Christmas, we've got confirmation that the festive period will continue, if safely to do so, in the Premier League. It means we've got a host of games coming up on St. Stephen's Day, including our live commentary on Off the Ball between Man City and Leicester. It's after clubs voted to continue with the season, despite the rise in cases, particularly with Omicron, in the Premier League. None of the clubs voted against taking a circuit break, so we know the festive football will now be continuing. A packed show coming up on Tuesday's OTBM between now and 10. We'll be talking about rugby with Stephen Ferris, the former Ireland and Ulster back row. Ulster up against Connacht in the interprovincial games this weekend, and Munster will host Leinster after what's been a messy last few days due to COVID-19. We know that the URC schedule is going to move around, and we'll be talking about the fallout from the Champions Cup last weekend as well, where seven games were postponed, but crucially not Leinster's, and they have an appeal in currently against the 28-0 loss that was inflicted on them when they didn't travel to play against Montpellier last Friday. We'll be talking to Paul Kilgannon about his new book, Journaling, Coaching and also being a sports person, and the benefits of writing down your goals during a given week. Particularly Dan Carter has been talking about this recently, and we'll be hearing from Gerry Thornley and from Fiona Hayes. Phil Egan is going to be along with us to look at the Premier League continuing and also the fixtures this week in the EFL Cup as well. Delighted to say that we're joined by Colm Bouygues, our resident tennis expert as well. Colm, how are you getting on?
Will O'Callaghan, Merry Christmas.
Yeah,
or as Bing Crosby and the Andrews sisters say to me in my Christmas playlist, Meli Kaliki Maka, a great Christmas song. Highly recommended.
Right, you're all set for Christmas. You were saying to the lads before we even come on air that there's a different feast tradition in Cork. Are you not a turkey or goose man? I heard you talking about spiced beef.
Spiced beef, fantastic Cork tradition, but I've heard that it's gone far and wide, as far as Offaly. Is that correct?
Yeah, a few years ago we had spiced beef as opposed to having the turkey. We kind of tend to mix it up because, like, turkey and ham is great, but it gets a little bit boring if you don't have something different. So are you like a regular spiced beef kind of family in Cork, or is it just something that gets pulled out on occasion?
No, we are a regular spiced beef family, but I actually resisted the urge for many a year because it was a bit too exotic for my taste buds in my formative years. But I grew into it, Will, and it became a part of my life in my 20s. And I'm glad to say that I'm a fully-fledged member of the Spice Bees Club now, because if I wasn't, I would be doing my county a massive disservice, as you probably know.
Yeah.
So the spice beef is thrown in with the ham and the turkey. I think it's a lovely evolution of flavour, because I, for one, am not the biggest turkey fan, but I love ham and I really like spice beef.
Well, look, you can always have turkey and ham on St. Stephen's Day. Mix it up, have the spice beef on the 25th and have your turkey on the 26th. We're going to have football on the 26th, Colm, because of that decision which was made by the Premier League clubs yesterday. There's a few kind of interesting points to come out of it. The first one being that the clubs were very much insistent that they wanted to continue with the games being played over the festive period. Each club is going to play three games between Sunday the 26th and the 3rd of January. So there's quite a host of football coming up. That's on the back of a weekend last weekend where, you know, six fixtures were lost. There was only just the one game on Saturday between Leeds and Arsenal. Maybe the line that's most important is when it's safe to do so, but there seems a real determination for a variety of reasons that the Premier League clubs want to continue with football over this festive period.
Yeah, and I'm surprised by it, because the tone from Jurgen Klopp in the last match of the weekend between Tottenham Hotspur and Liverpool kind of suggested to me that it was inevitable that we were going to hear of the deferral of at least one set of fixtures, and probably that a couple of days between the 28th and 30th of December, those Amazon games basically. And I was fully prepared for those to be postponed until sometime in the new year. But no, they've proceeded. And I guess they just want to get the fixtures done. I mean, we're seeing the same problem in rugby at the moment. Like, Omicron has just taken over completely in the last couple of weeks. And, like, Will, the funny thing is, we're nearly 2 years into this pandemic, and you're still shocked sometimes at the speed of events. And this kind of has taken me back over the last couple of weeks, because I kind of thought we were over the phase of fixtures being called off because of COVID, but the weekend just gone. Like that Aston Villa game 2 hours before kickoff just to be shelved. And then at that stage, wasn't even that surprised about it, but I guess they got their heads together, And I guess the majority ruled that, no, we're going to go on here. We're going to drive on. And I'd love, I would love to get the genuine, honest opinions of the players and all of this, and how many actually do want to play, and how many kind of secretly are like, I kind of love Christmas off. I'd love if these games were kind of postponed until the new year, you know? Well, and I would love if there was a bit of a survey done on that between the players.
Yeah, because like the clubs are driven perhaps by different factors. And again, last week we heard talk about potentially the broadcasters having to get a rebate on the massive sums of money that they throw in to broadcast games if we were to lose fixtures over the festive period. And the clubs would have had that in the back of their mind. Like, it's far from ideal from a fan experience too. Like, I was looking at fans complaining, Burnley fans particularly, who made their way to the Brentford game. Somewhere in the car park, an hour and a half before the game was due to take place, they find out that that half seven fixture last Wednesday wasn't going to go ahead. I say the Aston Villa game was pulled 2 hours before kickoff. Like, if you're travelling, you know, across the UK, which away fans do, and even at this time of year, they make those trips, far from ideal if you found yourself pretty close to the ground that you're going to and a fixture has been lost because there's six or seven cases in the club. Like, we're right on the back of what's been a record week, 90 cases among staff and players within the Premier League. We're so used to those releases coming out each Monday and almost ignoring them because it's one case, two cases, it was 42 the week before and now 90. It's very clear that quite a few squads have been heavily affected by COVID-19. So postponements are not exactly entirely ruled out either. They could still be some last minute postponements this weekend.
Totally. I mean, of the nine games happening on St. Stephen's Day, I mean, how many do we expect to actually go ahead? Like, sitting here right now, I would be very, very surprised if all nine were played. But you just don't know. And like you say, the fans are really being impacted by this. And like, again, it's kind of the match-going supporters are the ones who are kind of last thought of oftentimes with these things. And as I said, a couple hours before kickoff, the game's shelved. And those people's plans are shelved, but their money has already been taken. They've come up with a new plan then. If you're not going to the game, it's not so bad. It's more of an inconvenience and you watch something else on TV, which might be the case this St. Stephen's Day if a lot of games are called off. But you don't know, Will. You don't know where it's going to go at this stage. You could have one, you could have nine games this coming weekend. But you'd imagine that the COVID situation won't improve that dramatically this week to allow all those games to go ahead. Do you know, like, what do you think? Do you think all the games, would you predict that all the games will go ahead on Sunday?
I would definitely have a fair amount of pessimism about it happening, just purely because people are naturally, even though most of these players are in quote unquote a bubble and are therefore, you know, basically keeping to themselves for the best part. But then you see the newspapers this morning and the fact that Phil Foden and Jack Grealish were dropped by Man City last week because they went clubbing after their win against Leeds and Pep Guardiola dropped them. Like, players are naturally going to be out among people in society. They're going to be with their family over this Christmas period. It's remarkably easy with this strain being very transmissible for someone to catch COVID-19. And unlike the start of the pandemic where, you know, it was almost seen that you were not being careful if you caught COVID-19, I think the thinking has changed around that. There's a strong chance the clubs are going to have large numbers. Like, look at Spurs. Even you take what Antonio Conte has had to say. He's like, look, we were hit with 13 cases across our squad. Are you going to punish us for the fact that, you know, people have caught COVID-19 at a time when there's 90,000 cases per day in the UK? Just naturally, I think some squads are going to be hit. And like, you might even see more players who are asymptomatic picking up positive test results because of the increase in lateral flow tests before they go into training grounds. And also they're doing a double set of PCR tests now each week in the Premier League. Like, naturally, probably more cases are going to be picked up than were before when it was only one test per week.
Exactly. And I mean, what are they going to do? Like, what's the alternative here? Do you scrap the whole season? I mean, you're going to have to keep on going because there is, it's almost a temptation to get into this mindset where this is a real short-term problem, that this variant is going to be done once Christmas and New Year is finished, you know, and we'll all go back to normal in January. But this is going to take quite a while to get over this variant. So inevitably, players are going to be really impacted by then. By that case, in January, come in February as well, it's going to be the same situation. So then you're thinking, well, do you postpone a month, 2 months worth of fixtures? You can't. You have to keep them going. And I guess then the question is, come the end of the season, is there a big asterisk next to the winner of the league? I mean, I don't necessarily think so, because it would probably still be one of the two big boys in the league. It would be either Man City or Liverpool. Can't see Chelsea winning the league. So it mightn't impact that much, but certainly the other end of the table, when it comes to relegation, there will be a lot of looking back saying, well, we at the field, you know, basically our youth academy, at least on the bench and a few in the starting lineup as well. So there's going to be a real kind of bitterness, I think, towards the 2021-22 Premier League season when it's all said and done by those involved and by those who are negatively impacted the most with it. And unfortunately, it's completely out of everyone's control. And yeah, that's the world we live in now.
I think, again, we'll be chatting to Stephen Ferris about the rugby a little bit later, but the lack of time is the big problem that the Premier League's rulemakers now have, because next season they're trying to fit in 18 rounds before early November, because they have to take a very short break ahead of the World Cup in Qatar. And even at that, it's 1 week's preparation as things stand for Qatar. And players who come back from the World Cup, if, say, some of the Premier League players go far into that World Cup, they could be back out playing in the league a week later, just after Christmas. So there's no real room for this season to be extended on, like has happened in the 1920 season when, you know, remarkable circumstances, they had to push back into the summer and they finished the season late. That's not going to be a runner because of the way that next season is set up. They've already put in some measures to try and cut down on congestion in January, like there's going to be no replays in round 3 and 4 of the FA Cup. And they're going to basically push through, get the Carabao Cup finished, and then they're going to try and fit in the season and get it done as quickly as possible. But there's effectively a round of Premier League games from last week which are already sitting there. We know that Spurs have been eliminated now from the Conference League because there was no room to reschedule their game against Rennes. And I hope that we don't get back to a point, Colm, and this would be the concern, where the grounds end up empty again and we end up having midweek fixtures. Like, we put up with it in 1920 because this was all new. But my word, it was painful watching RB Leipzig against Man City a couple of weeks ago in the Champions League, and Bayern Munich against Barcelona when the German government put the grounds back to empty again. Like, behind closed doors football is very, very possible now.
Oh, absolutely. Like, will I remember that first behind closed doors match in the Premier League, Aston Villa against Sheffield United? And it was a bit of a novelty, you know, to see the... It was almost like having VIP access to a high-octane training session at the start, and it was, you know, this is kind of interesting to see. It's almost like an experiment, a social study. But then, Jesus, that got tedious very, very fast. And that absolutely could, I feel like that would be the last resort in order for matches to continue, that they will get rid of fans again. But, like, well, the overall point here is, like, you know, COVID aside, like, where even are we with football these days? Because there are just so many games on. Like, there are just so many matches. It's like every 2 to 3 days. We're getting to this stage now where, like, next winter we're going to have a World Cup. And I just want to know where's football even going here? Because we're trying to pack more and more and more and more games in for the benefit of the viewer to make more money from it. But, like, at some stage, do you question, like, where are players' passions going to go here? Are they really going to treat this like an actual job and just have to go into the office, get this game done, get out, go to the next game? And the whole joy of football and the reason that you get into it is surely questioned by a lot of people. And Kevin De Bruyne has said this, I think, more than 6 months ago at this stage. He said, we're playing so much football, we're going to start breaking down here. Mm. And you have cases now where players are being rushed back because squads are so thin because of injuries, suspensions and COVID, that players are breaking down again. And like you say, there's not many windows for these postponements to be played. You get to the summer, players will be so relieved for a break. But really, like, will they're going to be, especially international players, they're going to go into this new season with all the domestic schedule still good to go, European football good to go, and then they have to play a World Cup. At some point, will they're going to stop caring?
Yeah.
Surely they're going to stop caring.
No, it's an absolute nightmare. Right, let's have a look at what's coming up. OTBM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We're going to be having a chat about Ireland's most admired sports people in a moment. Then Colm, who is our resident tennis expert here in OTB, is going to look at what perhaps a Drive to Survive style tennis documentary might look like. Stephen Ferris is going to be along with us after 8 o'clock to have a look at the fallout from the Champions Cup from last weekend. It wasn't a bad one for the Irish provinces. Connacht, even in their defeat against the Premiership leaders Leicester, still picked up a defensive bonus point. They go to Ulster this weekend, who've made it 2 wins from 2 in the Champions Cup, and Munster also 2 from 2. Wasn't particularly pretty against Cass last weekend, but the Reds putting their issues with COVID-19 and travel behind them to pick up 2 victories from 2 so far in European competition. We're going to have a look at the sports back pages then, just after 8:30. Colm Mullany will be along to bring us up to speed on all the sports news, including Mona McSharry breaking more Irish records and getting a bronze medal in the 100 metres breaststroke at the short distance World Championships, which are on at the moment in Abu Dhabi. We've got more Irish swimmers in the pool later on today as well. We'll be talking to Paul Kilgannon about his new book and also ways of charting your goals and making yourself accountable by writing down what you want to achieve in a given week at around 10 to 9. And then Phil Egan is going to be along with us to look at all the football news, including the EFL Cup, which is on this week. Arsenal are in action against Sunderland tonight. We'll look forward to the Premier League games at the weekend. And also, it was a pretty busy 24 hours with transfers in the League of Ireland, including Sean Murray making the trip from Dundalk to Glentoran ahead of next season. So all that to come here on OTB AM. Colm, we also had a survey which is in the back pages of the newspapers today. It was a Tenio Sports survey which came out. It was 1,000 people who were surveyed in all. And according to the people you can probably see on screen now, the most admired Irish athlete, Katie Taylor, 16%, Kelly Harrington, 14%. So those two boxers accounting for more than a quarter of all the votes here. Rachel Blackmore, who had her winning weekend with the Irish Times Awards, the BBC World Sports Person, and also the RTÉ Sports Person of the Year across the weekend on 9%, along with Johnny Sexton, the Ireland and Leinster rugby captain. Paula Donovan, 4%. I'm sure we'll get your Cork opinion on that in a moment. I thought he was very unlucky, along with Fintan, not to win Team of the Year at the RTÉ Awards of the weekend. Ellen Keane on 4%, Tadhg Furlong on 4%, and the Ireland soccer captain Katie McCabe also on 4%. They're the most admired athlete. We'll talk about the moment of the year and the sports teams in a moment, Colm, but just to go with most admired, probably no great surprise that Katie Taylor and Kelly Harrington are there. Like, Katie Taylor probably steps up for her next year with Amanda Serrano, which is the fight we've been waiting for so long, but she's come through 2021 with her undisputed lightweight world titles in tow. And Kelly Harrington, for me, probably moment of the year, was getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to watch her final at the Tokyo Games. She's been embraced, but I noticed across this survey there's not actually a huge, let's say, love reflection on the Olympic teams. Is that because everything was at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning and maybe people didn't attach on in the way they usually do for an Olympics, or what do you think the reasoning is behind that?
Yeah, I think there are a variety of reasons that people really get attached to someone. I think it's easier when it's an individualistic sport, something like that, if people aren't necessarily avid fans of the particular sport. And I think if a team is really going to catch the imagination, I think each member has to have a really big personality or distinctive character trait, or something really monumental has to happen in their chosen sport to really capture the public imagination. So I think that leaves us with the more individual sports. And it's absolutely no surprise to see Kelly Harrington up so high. And it's actually great to see, because, like you referred to it there with that Olympic final, I actually can't remember any sporting event where I was more nervous, especially in the second round. I remember watching it, and it wasn't just the stereotypical edge of your seat, but I was shaking a little. You know, it was kind of an uncontrollable moment, because I really, really wanted her to win. And then when she did, and just the pure unadulterated joy on her face, and then the homecoming, and like, it's been such a dark 2 years, and for Kelly Harrington just to light up the country and again transcend the sport, everybody for those few days were just on high as a result of her achievements. And I think that's what really captures the public imagination, and that's sport at its best. You know, sport at its best garners interest from people who have absolutely no interest in it, and that's what it can do, because it's all down to human emotion. So I think that's why you're seeing so many individualistic sports up there, because the best sports stars are a reflection of the people themselves, and I think Kelly Harrington is a national treasure as a result.
Yeah, I wonder if her humility and, you know, Hakuna Matata, and just how relaxed she was during the Olympics, and I guess that access that you get from an interview that takes place after each fight, and where she was very much to the fore. Like, this kind of reminds me of when it was the O'Donovan brothers who were in the boat together back in 2016, that like, their popularity exploded because of how interesting they were after the races, and so many people started watching rowing because it was like, these two guys are remarkably entertaining. Not only are they incredibly good athletes, but they also make for good television.
Yeah, I mean, look, how interesting is rowing to people who have no interest in it? You know, it's really hard to get into rowing, because you're just watching this repetitive exercise. Now, the rowing community will be like, what are you talking about? You don't know, you're so ignorant. What are you talking about?
You're going to be banned from Cork, Colm. You're not going to get back home for Christmas.
I bring it home, Will, don't worry. I'll bring it around. But I would say, like, if you're looking at this, like, objective repetition of motion, you're like, oh my God, you know, what's going to happen? Is there a through ball that can happen here? Like, is there a red card or something? Can I stick my teeth into this? But then you have the characters and they get out of the boat and they talk, and then, okay, I'm immediately buying into this because these guys are so passionate about what they do. And if you listen to someone who has passion about what they do, you're immediately a bit interested, no matter what it is, because you're buying into them as people. And that's what happened with Paul and Gary Donovan at 2016 Olympics. And as a result, we've seen in subsequent years is that, you know, Paul is genuinely world-class in his field and, you know, described as a bit of a genetic freak. Mm. And Fintan McCarthy's brilliant too, but Fintan would say the same thing about Paul. And then, you know, you have kind of the, you know, maybe the bittersweet element too that Gary, I think, as Paul and Fintan took home the gold in Tokyo, was, I think, reportedly, you know, in the air, might not have even seen the race. And, you know, you do feel for him a bit too, and you think there might be a bit of a divide in the family about being absolutely thrilled for one member and then, you know, a bit sad for the other. So, you know, that narrative, I guess, again, just continues to capture the imagination. But it's the people in the boat that really that we're getting behind. And to have genuine world-class athletes like Paul and Fintan, like Kelly Harrington, like Katie Taylor, like, it is absolutely brilliant because, like, I get a bit tired of the stereotype of Irish sports people that, you know, we try very hard, we give it our all, but we kind of lack a bit of skill. But that's absolutely not the case, that we actually are quite skillful across a number of sports. And I think in 2021, we've displayed that on a world stage. And there's an awful lot to be proud of as a result.
Yeah, I think it's not insignificant as well when you look at this on the back of the promotion of women's sport over the last 18 months in particular with 2020. You've got Katie Taylor, Kelly Harrington, Rachel Blackmore, Ellen Keane and Katie McCabe all inside the top seven here. Like, it's a pretty female-dominated most admired list. Moment of the year, no great surprise, we talked about it already, Kelly Harrington's gold coming in at 20%. The Ireland rugby team beating New Zealand at 19%, I wonder, is a combination of maybe those who were surveyed and also a certain amount of recency bias too. Look, it was great to have a full crowd back at the Aviva Stadium, but ultimately it was an Autumn International as opposed to, I think, the 11% Rachel Blackmore's wins at Aintree and Cheltenham are far more significant. Winning the champion hurdle, becoming top jockey at Cheltenham, winning the Aintree Grand National, first female jockey ever to do so. 10% coming in for the rowing gold at the Olympics. So, like, there's a big split in terms of moment of the year. But I'm not sure, Colm, if the Ireland team beating New Zealand, as fine a performance as it was, is it really the second best Irish sporting moment of the year?
Yeah, totally. And do you know why? It was...
Above Olympic gold medals.
Well, it was a controlled, relatively comfortable victory in the end. And the reason that it's so high up is because, again, it was kind of displaying world-class tendencies, I would say, when it comes to the rugby team. Not quite a world-class team yet, but it was a really well-deserved victory, whereas the one in 2018 was so unbelievably dramatic. And then in Chicago before that, it was like, oh my God, this feels like an incredible one-off achievement that we can all celebrate as a nation and remember it fondly years on. But the most recent iteration of the victory against New Zealand was very kind of calm, controlled, measured victory. And I think there's a lot to be said for that because, as I was saying there, with the when you're caught up with the emotion of a sport that you might not be that interested in, this is a national sport that, you know, we're one of the best countries in the world at. And we actually illustrated it that day with kind of a consummate professional victory over, you know, the great All Blacks. And I actually fully agree that it should be that high. I think with Rachel Blackmore, this is just a complete theory, obviously, and, you know, clearly an opinion. But it's because that, I think it's because her dominance was so consistent throughout that week that maybe there wasn't one solidified moment that you could grab onto. I'm just speculating. That's maybe
what about the Grand National? The Grand National genuinely sticks out as a
completely. No, I completely. But because it wasn't just that, maybe that's why it's a bit lower. Because there wasn't one particular moment like you're looking at reading in the years in 20 years' time. Is that the absolute moment that we can grab onto? That okay. That was the best sporting moment of the year.
See,
maybe.
I think now, if you want a reading in the years moment column on rugby, right, and Ireland beat New Zealand, if Ireland beat New Zealand in France in 2023, then that becomes a reeling in the years moment. I think this is a victory in a test match that's part of an autumn series where the All Blacks were wrecked. We saw that against France as well. Enjoy the moment, by all means, but I don't know how that gets ahead of Blackmore. I don't know how that gets ahead of the guys winning the gold medal in the rowing. again, to each their own. This is a survey of only 1,000 people as well. Favourite team then? We had the Olympics Irish team getting 24%. The men's rugby team coming in on 22%, which is again why I wonder about maybe some of the people who were surveyed here by putting the men's rugby team up there, albeit they had a good year. They won, what, 8 test matches during the year. Paralympics at 15%. You've got the women's soccer team coming in at 12%. I think they've gained a lot of love with the extended exposure that they've gotten with all the TV coverage and also marketing campaigns, and they've been very much out to the fore. I'm a little bit surprised, Colm, to be honest, the Limerick hurling team gets 12%, because I think at some point people will turn against the Limerick team if they continue to dominate hurling. And already there's a bit of a discussion about whether they overstep the mark physically and the way that they play the game. It always happens when a team is successful. I think when Limerick first came through in 2018, it was like a famine has been ended since the 1970s. Mm. They play some great hurling. Look at the players they have, the way they move the ball. They can shoot from all over the pitch. Now that they've been, you know, collecting multiple league titles, Munster titles, and, you know, they've dominated the All-Ireland over the last 3 seasons, I think at some point that love for the Limerick hurling team is going to turn, a little bit like the Dublin football team. Like, no one really begrudged the Dublin football team at the turn of the last decade. But once it started to turn into 4 All-Irelands in a row, 5 All-Irelands in a row, people wanted the change and someone else to win.
Yeah, 2011 seems a long time ago for Dublin's victory, you know, from 1995 to then. And now it's like, oh God, Dublin. And yeah, Limerick, like, I was there that day, 2018, the semi-final when Cork were 8 points ahead with 8 minutes to go, I think.
Yep.
And then Limerick were, you know, they, I think Dowling came on and just changed the whole game. And now 3 years on, you're like, yeah, Limerick are absolutely unbelievable. But I absolutely don't begrudge their consistent success, because they make hurling so enjoyable to watch. Like, is it tiki-taka, Limerick's hurling? Because their passing is just unbelievable to watch. Like, they're a genuine joy. And if that success and, I wouldn't say dominance, but certainly being the best team in the country, if that continues for the next decade, I don't think I'll have much of a problem. If you sprinkle in a Cork victory here and there, I'll absolutely take that. But no, they're a joy. They're absolutely a joy. But I think your point is interesting, that will people start getting sick of them? You see, people get sick of winners. You know, I don't know if it's a national psyche that we don't like people who are too obvious and insist upon themselves that they're so good over a prolonged period of time. Like, as a country, do we just like a one-off winner that's very humble about it? And, you know, I'm very thankful for all the support, and it was just great to be out there, and I can't believe I won. I couldn't have done it without you. Mm. And then they kind of disappear for a while, especially as a team. But I think it's great. I think we should embrace this American style of absolute dominance, whether it's on the domestic or international front.
Well, see, I think the only thing Limerick lead now, which is outside of their own control, they need a dance partner. So they need a team who get up to their level consistently, and there's a series of interesting games between them. Because one of the reasons that Dublin became such an interesting team to watch was because of the battles they had against Mayo. Mayo came up short and Dublin came out on top pretty much in all of them. But Dublin's brilliance was actually improved by Mayo being a really good opponent for them during the period where they were successful. We saw Kilkenny match up very well against Limerick in 2019 and beat them in a semi-final. But generally, Limerick have found the answer against the rest of the teams around them in the All-Ireland Championship. They could do with Henry Shefflin making Galway excellent, or Kilkenny getting back up to a level, or Tipperary next year getting back to their 2019 level again and being a very, very difficult opponent to shake off. I think that makes Limerick a little bit more interesting. I want to talk to you about Drive to Survive in a moment, just to tell you about the other one, which is the event that people are most looking forward to in 2022. Six Nations on 29%, the FIFA World Cup 26%, All-Ireland Hurling at 12%, and All-Ireland Football at 9%. The one that surprised me is the World Cup at 26%, because I think a lot of people are, you know, football fans are sharing concerns about the time it's on, where it is, what it's going to have an impact on the domestic season. But yet, sports fans appear to be still very interested in the World Cup. Favourite sport, tennis coming in at 6%. Let's find a way to actually to get that up the way here, Colm. You've been looking at the idea of potentially, we call it a Drive for Survive style programme, potentially, for the tennis circuit. And I think what I mean is not directly like the makers of Drive to Survive doing it, because I think some of the people who are involved in that production with Netflix are now looking at horse racing currently, and potentially some other sports could come under the banner because it's been so successful and has drawn in an audience. And I think it's actually improved Formula One's appeal hugely among casual sports fans. If a tennis series was to come out, who are we following? Who's going to be interesting if there was a TV series about tennis right now?
First of all, it should be called What a Racket, if it is to be a series. Or New Balls, please. Or just New Balls! Like Airplane. exclamation point. So I've been working on names. There's so much to follow, Will. There's so much. See, you have the big three in the men's game, and they're all coming to the end now, and they're all tied on 20 Grand Slams each. So that's, of course, Novak Djokovic, Rafael Nadal, and Roger Federer. So you have that narrative. You want to see that behind the scenes. Then you have Serena Williams, who is chasing that elusive 24th Grand Slam, the American court record. She's been on 23 for a number of years now. She's reached four Grand Slam finals since she's come back from her maternity leave, and she's lost them all quite convincingly. And both she and Federer are now 40, and you think their chances of adding to their already, you know, monumental haul is more limited with each passing week, month, and year. And the reason that a Drive to Survive style documentary would be so interesting would be to, I suppose, see them in their, you know, not to be too voyeuristic, but see them in their lower moments, just to see the real side of them. And you see, the thing with, like, the thing with this whole series, right, Formula One, is that, you know, it was a bit of a polarizing sport. Like, the fans of Formula One were, you know, you won't get much more passionate, but there was a lot of people outside, you know, to use your dancing analogy there, that Limerick need a dance partner. You know, Formula One fans were like the young fella at a wedding with the tie around the head, sliding on the knees. And the rest of us were on the outside, like the aunt and uncle who might go up for a little dance and walk away.
So you're trying to say they preferred him as a bit more pure, when, like, maybe Formula One wasn't quite as mass appeal, and everyone was sitting down last Sunday week to watch that crazy final lap to see if Verstappen could get past Lewis Hamilton. Like, probably what helped Drive to Survive, and this would be important for tennis too, and look, I think tennis is interesting enough to make this a good series, is that Drive to Survive may well have drawn eyeballs to the sport, but the magnificent title race that was there this season also increased the interest in Formula One. I think if you get a Drive for Survive style tennis, and you get, say, Serena Williams losing a Grand Slam final and potentially having the cameras embedded with her camp while she's throwing a tantrum after losing, or Novak Djokovic doesn't win Australia next month and the cameras are along with them, that makes particularly interesting viewing. We actually, it's one of those things where you can open the door and get an idea of what the sports people are like behind the interview that we hear on centre court after they lose or win a match.
Mm. Well, like, there's absolutely no question that the Verstappen-Hamilton rivalry was brought to a far wider audience because of Drive to Survive. I mean, there's just no doubt about that. So for the last two Sundays, people have been glued to their screens because of Drive to Survive, a lot of people. And they are buying into the personalities, which is kind of the theme of the morning that we've discussed so far, is the personality behind sports people. And I, as a tennis fan and someone who talks about tennis on off the ball a lot, you know, sometimes you kind of get a polarizing reaction in that you get a lot of passionate people about certain players, and then a lot of apathy towards others, because those others, they're not really that well known and their personalities don't come to the fore. And tennis can be often a very cold and individualistic sport.
Is there a little bit as well, Colm, of a kind of a Cristiano Ronaldo, Leo Messi type thing here, where you get some fans who are so wedded to Roger Federer that therefore they will play down the achievements of Rafa Nadal or a Djokovic. You're almost like you're a Djokovic, Nadal or Federer fan, as opposed to being a wider tennis fan who can maybe appreciate that all three are among the best players of all time.
Oh, it's like a football team. Like, Will, you look at the comment section, right, on a recent Novak Djokovic segment that we would have done on OTB AM, and to describe some of the comments as vitriolic would be generous. I mean, people are like waving their Djokovic scarves around, taking off their shirt, have Novak's face tattooed on their body, like that episode of Alan Partridge with the Stalker. Like, serious love eyes towards certain players, and as you say, complete disregard towards others, or more to the point, disregard towards pundits' opinions of them if they're not too generous. So, you know, Jarrod Gilroy and I would not be a fan of Novak Djokovic, and every time we discuss him, the comment section goes pretty wild. So it's a really interesting thing, because when we do tennis on the show, sometimes, you know, the videos have crazy huge views and loads of engagement in the comments. And then other times people just aren't that interested in it, because for the lesser known players, there's nothing to get in about the sport, right? And tennis does itself no favors. It really needs to modernize. And there actually is talk of doing a Drive to Survive for tennis, just like there's for horse racing. And Mariam Bartoli, who won Wimbledon in 2013, she says that tennis needs a behind-the-scenes documentary to actually showcase the real personalities, because there are some brilliant people in tennis. There's some really great personalities, and there's so much beef as well, Will, because it's such a selfish sport, and everybody's out for themselves. So, like, I'll give you one example off the top of my head. US Open last year, or this year, sorry, Stefanos Tsitsipas against Andy Murray in the first round. Now, those two guys do get on, but Tsitsipas is going for a number of bathroom breaks and medical timeouts, and Murray was absolutely fuming at him, right? And let the umpire know on certain terms. Now, the mics pick up certain things that they say, and all you want is to hear what they're saying when they're away from the court and behind the scenes, because you know it's way worse than that. And, like, after that incident when Tsitsipas kept him going to the bathroom, taking ages to come back, completely destroying Murray's momentum. That was a 5-set victory for Tsitsipas, so it went all the way. So Tsitsipas knew what he was doing. Andy Murray tweeted afterwards, "Fact of the day, it takes Stefanos Tsitsipas twice as long to go to the bathroom as it takes Jeff Bezos to fly into space." Interesting. So, right, you get that real passive aggression that you've always had with Andy Murray anyway. He's very good at it. And then you magnify that to both the WTA and ATP tours, fill them in the locker rooms where they're going around talking to each other, saying what to each other under each other's breath. Oh, it would be absolutely beautiful. And, like, will you take just the last year alone, right? If there was a Drive to Survive, or What a Racket, as we'll call it, for the last year, you have, like, the Australian Open. Do you remember that with the quarantining issues?
Yep.
Where 72 players had to go into hard hotel quarantine for 2 weeks. And actually, Jennifer Brady was one of those players, and she reached the final, despite not leaving her hotel room for a fortnight. So can you imagine getting the opinions of Novak Djokovic behind the scenes? Because he was the one who said to the Australian officials, "Look, any chance that these quarantine restrictions can be eased for us? Can we get, you know, nicer food? Can we see our coaches?" And then you have Nick Kyrgios responding to that, saying, "What a tool," about Djokovic. So you just love to see that beef. And you and I were texting last night about this ahead of the segment and said, for Nick Kyrgios alone, you'd invest in this series.
That's the episode everyone would watch. Like, you'd be intrigued by, say, Raducanu's US Open victory.
Oh, yeah.
Would be like a great episode in and of itself, but just watching Nick Kyrgios talk crap about his fellow players would be the one that you'd sit down to watch. You'd probably put it right middle of the series. All right, plenty coming up on OTBN between now and 10 o'clock. We're going to be hearing from Paul Kilgannon on his book in the next hour. But next, we're going to be talking rugby with Stephen Ferris. Before that, we bring you a clip during the break from our American football show, It's the Snap.
OTB
AM. All right, The Snap is brought to you in association with the Aer Lingus College Football Classic. Tickets are available now for the game, which is coming up at the Aviva Stadium on August the 27th of 2022. It's going to be Northwestern against Nebraska. You can get updates on all things American football by signing up to our newsletter here at OTB Sports. All you have to do is go to otbsports.com/club. Gridiron. Now, with the time coming up to 12 minutes after 8, it is time for us to chat about rugby from last weekend. It was a pretty decent one for the Irish provinces, all things considered. Ulster now 2 wins from 2, same with Munster, but the weekend was overshadowed by some of the decision making off the field. The French government putting in a travel ban between France and the UK just before the weekend, which meant the 7 matches between the French and UK sides were all postponed and they're going to be rescheduled. That was despite the organisers of the competition for the Heineken Champions Cup saying in early December that the room just wasn't there in the calendar to be able to reschedule matches. Leinster and the Ospreys can feel, I think, particularly hard done by. They've taken 28-0 losses which were inflicted upon them. It's because Leinster weren't able to play against Montpellier last Friday. They've appealed against that because Montpellier were given the 28-0 win despite the fact that there were cases in both camps, and Leinster had been given permission by the Irish government to travel to France. And they've registered nearly 70 players to play in the competition. And they were saying that they had a fit squad who were COVID-free that were going to be able to play. And they had a host of internationals who were in their starting 15 and felt that they could go across and win that game. So they've got their appeal in currently. We're waiting to see what's going to happen on that appeal. On the field, Ulster getting a bonus point win against Northampton by 27 points to 22. Connacht led with 50 minutes gone away to Leicester, who've been flying in the Premiership, but lost out 29-23. Perhaps crucially, though, Jack Carthy, with a drop goal late on, rescued a losing bonus point for Connacht. Connacht play Ulster in Kingspan Stadium this Sunday. And for Munster, may have been a little bit ugly on Saturday night in their game against Cass, but coming through by 19 points to 13. Healy's boot helping them over the line in the end. And they've got 2 from 2 and are well placed to qualify from this shortened pool, and it'll be Munster against Leinster at Thomond Park on Sunday night. Delighted to say we're joined now by former Ulster and Ireland back row Stephen Ferris to have a look at what's been happening in the Champions Cup and also look forward to those games in the URC Interpros at the weekend. Stephen, how are you getting on?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks for having me on. It's been a while since I've been on the show, so looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, maybe it's a good time to talk about Ulster, because Ulster shipped 30-odd points against Connacht just before the games were played in the Autumn Internationals, and you had Dan McFarland saying, you know, that game at the Aviva Stadium was a real low point with application and with effort from the team. But since then, like, some really good performances. It's a great start in Europe to beat Northampton and Clermont Auvergne. They've beaten Leinster since the international break too, and are now, like, pretty well placed to qualify for the knockout stage of the Champions Cup after that bonus point win last Friday.
Yeah, for sure. And I think after that Connacht game, I was sitting thinking to myself, geez, Ulster have a tough run of fixtures coming up, especially in the European Cup. Leinster away from home, you know, it's going to be a real tough time. But they've bounced back, and I think that result against Connacht was maybe a wake-up call that, you know, you got to approach every single game the same. Ulster were, you know, good going into that game, but just didn't perform at all. And, you know, very, very disappointing. And Dan McFarlane, I'm sure, wouldn't have been happy. And they've bounced back. And how can you bounce back better than beating Clermont away from home? And then, you know, a pretty convincing display against Northampton. You know, it was 19 points to 6 after 20 minutes. We all thought it was going to be a bit of a cricket score in the end, but Northampton didn't roll over. They have some really good players, Courtney Laws, you know, Tom Wood, Ludlam in the back row. They're not going to roll over. So, you know, they fought hard back into the game, but Ulster just too dominant. But a few injury concerns, that's the main thing for Ulster at the minute. We know that Jacob Stockfield's out, Will Addison's still out long term, but add in Rob Balakoon from the Clermont game. Ian Henderson went off injured yet again. The Six Nations is only 6.5 weeks away. You know, that's going to come around fast, and Ian Henderson's a big important player for Ireland and Ulster, of course. And lastly, Stuart McCluskey. Everything goes around Stuart McCluskey in an Ulster team. And when he went off the pitch, it seemed to be that Ulster lost their way a little bit, lost a bit of direction, a vocal point, like Stuart McCluskey always is. So if there's one negative to come away, it's just the build-up of injuries that, unfortunately, Ulster have accumulated.
Yeah, it puts a stress on the squad over this festive period, starting with that Connacht game this weekend. But do we write that Connacht game off at the Aviva then as one bad performance among a season? Because Ulster had started the season brilliantly, like bonus point wins in the first four fixtures, and then it goes wrong on that occasion. Players go off and a large Ulster contingent in with the Irish squad for the Autumn Internationals. They come back off the back of that and have now played really well in the last four fixtures. Do we just put that Connacht game off to one bad night then?
I think we do now. If there had been a repeat of that over the last couple of weeks, then maybe you look back on it and say, right, we need to dig a little bit deeper here. You also got to remember there was two intercept tries. Mac Hansen, you know, had an unbelievable game. There was only a couple of line breaks, and Connacht were really decisive and finished them off. Like Connacht against Leicester, I know we might touch on it. Like, they made over 400 plus running meters in the game, made 6 line breaks, but they only scored 2 tries, and they didn't really finish Leicester off, where they seemed to do that against Ulster a number of weeks ago. So, I think, you know, now you sort of draw a line in the sand over that result. And you move forward. And why not move forward? Because they're playing some outstanding rugby.
Yeah, I mean, look, they moved the ball around really well, which is where it's no surprise that, you know, so many players from Ulster got called up in the summer and then got brought back in by Andy Farrell for the recent Autumn Internationals as well. Like, you look at players like Hume, who's, like, really played well so far this season, like McIlroy among the tries, Craig Gilroy getting a try again last weekend. Like, that's even taken Balakoon not playing, Addison not playing. When all the backs are available, there's going to be some serious competition to get into that back three and into midfield for Ulster.
Yeah, there certainly is. And there's a certain Luke Marshall as well. I know he's a forgotten man. A bit like I was towards the end of my career. He's had so many injuries. He's obviously played a number of caps for Ireland. You know, that's looking back to 6-7 years ago now. But, you know, he's still in the picture there. He's coming back from a knee injury. Plenty of options there. But it's great to see these young guys. And I was asked the question a couple of years ago about, you know, how Ulster have got to keep moving forward. You've got to give these young fellas opportunity. But it's not just one or two games here and there sporadically throughout the season. You've got to give them consistent game time at a really high level. And, like, you know, Tom O'Toole over the last 2 years hasn't played in that many big games. Marty Moore, you know, has been the linchpin at tight head prop and had started so many games. And now all of a sudden you're getting young Tom O'Toole being thrown in against, really good quality French opposition in Clermont. You know, this is how these young guys learn their trade. And especially some of the young backs, like Ethan McElroy has been a revelation. He really has. So solid under the high ball, good kicking game, runs really gracefully across the pitch. He's quite fast, doesn't look it, but he's got a turn of speed. It's just giving these young fellas more and more opportunity. And And if you look at Leinster, that's what they've done over the last few years. And you always talk about the strength and depth, but it's because they're getting the chance, because they're stringing 3-4 games together. Like Scott Penny, when he first came on the scene, there was a couple of injuries in the back row, and all of a sudden he started 4, 5, 6 games, started getting a few tries, started playing in a nearly a full strength Leinster team. Then he gets recognised, and that's exactly the same as what Ulster have got to do. And I think over the last kind of 6 months they've been doing that, and I think their hand has been sort of forced a little because of some of the injuries that they've had to the team to get these young fellas in, but it just shows you that the quality is there.
Well, look, ahead of Sunday's game, I think we're going to talk about two forgotten men in the Irish setup in John Cooney and Jack Carthy, two former teammates who will be on opposite sides this weekend. Like, before we talk about Carthy, because understandably, like, rave reviews the way he's played over the last 4 or 5 weeks, and again, he was so much to the fore with Connacht getting a point out of the game at Welford Road at the weekend. But how well is John Cooney playing this season for Ulster, Stephen?
Yeah, he obviously was injured at the start of the season. Young Nathan Doak has come in and played brilliantly well. Very solid, really good goal kicker. But, you know, I think John Cooney coming back into the team, he either could have slipped off, went into his shell a little bit, throwing the toys out of the pram that Nathan's getting, you know, all the plaudits and his name's in the lights over the first couple of months of the season. But he didn't. He just knuckled down and got on with it. And that's a sign of a real quality, dedicated player. There's chit-chat going around that, is he going to be here at Ulster next season? I think one of the reasons why that chit-chat just continuously comes around is because he's not in the Irish setup. He hasn't been in the Irish setup for a couple of years. Yes, granted, he's been drafted in and out a few times, but he's so far down the pecking order, it seems, even though he's probably playing the best rugby, or has been playing consistently the best rugby out of the scrum halves over the last few years. And I'm sure that's bound to get you down a little bit. That's bound to get on top of you. So maybe there's something, you know, there's no smoke without fire, as we all know, that he's maybe going to disappear at some stage. It might not be this at the end of this season, but yeah, John's not going to hang around forever, and rightly so. And I'm sure a lot of clubs out there will want him. He's a quality player. He's been really good, solid rugby, brilliant goal kicker. And yeah, he's a top man for Ulster to have. And when he's in the team, he definitely makes Ulster a better side.
Yeah, for a Stephen, long time. Stephen, sorry, go on, Colin.
Sorry, Will. I was just wondering, Stephen, how far can Ulster go this season in Europe? Are we looking at a repeat of 2012 in the run?
Gee, I hope you're right. I think it all depends.
What would it take to get there?
Well, I think if you look back on the recent years when Ulster reached knockout games, they don't get them at home. They're always going away from home. They're always up against it. They're always underdogs. And even back in 2012, it took an unbelievable quarterfinal performance against Munster away to kind of get us to that final. And like, we didn't deserve to win the European Cup that year. Leinster were by far the best team in Europe. That team was just unbelievable. And for Ulster, I think it's, you know, kneeling down home knockout games, and you know, Ulster don't lose too many games at the Kingspan Stadium. The crowd there, I was there at the weekend, doing a few bits and bobs. It was a brilliant packed out stadium, considering all the crack that we're having at the minute with the COVID. You know, there was a brilliant turnout there. So yeah, Ulster, just get a home knockout and just keep the momentum going. Get a few of these guys back in, and you just don't know where we can go. But the expectation, Colm, is very high. It's very, very high. We always know it is high. It doesn't matter if you're whatever province you play for in Ireland. But at Ulster, I think it's specifically quite high this season, considering where they're at. And Dan McFarland is in now. He hasn't just arrived. He's been there for a significant period of time. He's got all his coaching staff that he wants. He's built a squad. He's got World Cup winners and Dwayne Vermeulen there. He's other guys that he's brought in. You know, this is his baby. This is his team. And, you know, this is probably the season that he's going to try and get that little bit of silverware. But there's other teams that you haven't mentioned in Europe that will certainly put a fight up the Ulster.
Yeah, Connacht had to wait half a century to win a game in Belfast. But yet, they've kind of got the upper hand in this fixture over the last little while, Stephen. They won three of the last four games between the sides. Like, Connacht have been good in the last few weeks. Like, they came off the international break playing free-flowing rugby like we saw against Ulster at the Aviva just before the international break. Got a good result weekend one in the Champions Cup. And ultimately, a losing bonus point away to Leicester might still help them to get through to the knockout stages of the Champions Cup this season. The only one annoyance, I guess, for Connacht last weekend was the great position they were in with half an hour to go. Now, Leicester's bomb squad went and won enough penalties for Leicester to be able to win the game. But Connacht will probably feel that they should have closed it out when they got into such a strong position.
Yeah, it's a funny, like, the mentality sort of shifted when the bench was unloaded. A couple of penalties, you know, a couple of scrum decisions as well went against Connacht. But they're sitting fourth in Pool B on 6 points. They're in a really strong position. Of course, there's a couple other big hitters, you know, that have a game in hand that are going to come charging in the next few games when their games get back on again. But I just like the brand of rugby that Connacht play. I know everybody talks about it. You know, it's long gone the days where you go down to Connacht and you're just scrumming and mauling and, you know, kicking to the corners and hoping the weather closes in and Connacht grind out a result. They're playing some top-notch rugby. And this is the concern for me with Ulster, is that when they come up against teams that like to throw the ball around, that like to play a very similar type of game plan to them, that they can struggle a little bit more. And Connacht is certainly one of those sides. They've been a bit of a bogey team of late. And, you know, Connacht are going to come to Belfast off the back of a brilliant result over down at the Aviva Stadium against Ulster. And then just keeping a little bit of momentum going. That Jack Carty last-minute drop goal, they get the losing bonus point. It just it makes a big difference. Those small winning margins make a big difference. And Jack Carty, I know you might want to touch on him now. He's certainly in a rich vein of form. And anytime I flick on Twitter, all I see is Jack Carty in the frame for Ireland. Jack Carty putting his hand up yet again for Ireland. Like, this has been just constant and constant. And there is a big media drive to get him back in there. Of course there is. Why wouldn't there be? The standard of rugby that he's playing, captaining Connacht, leading by example. Are the other 10s playing as well? Harry Byrne, Ross Byrne, probably not. Billy Burns, he's just been going steady. So, it's an interesting conversation that's going to pop up in the next few weeks.
Yeah, because, look, I think Billy Burns, after last year's Six Nations, dropped down the pecking order a little bit, and it felt like the Irish coaching team made a decision at that stage that they were going in pretty heavy on Harry Byrne. But then, again, Harry Byrne's missed Leinster's last couple of games. He's not got that kind of big game experience. While the argument would be that in the here and the now, and there is a World Cup to look forward to in 2023, but Jack Carty, outside of Johnny Sexton, has been the form out half in the country. So therefore, you know, that's him putting his hand up to actually be picked for the upcoming Six Nations, especially if Joey Carberry is going to be out for a little while with injury. We don't know how many games he's going to get before the Six Nations squad is picked. I can see why there's an argument for Jack Carty, who's been in great form for the last 8 weeks particularly, would actually get picked to come in.
Yeah, and I would have him there. I would definitely have him there. And players just want to be picked on form. And if you're playing really, really well and that door's continuously shut, it gets on top of you. I suppose the John Cooney situation is maybe slightly different, but Jack Carty has been sensational. He really has. And I think if he's, you know, put behind a really, really dominant pack, you know, if Jack Carty was playing for Leinster every single week, you know, would he be even better? I think he probably would. And I think he deserves a shot in the Six Nations. And is he number two right now? I certainly think he is. You know, Harry Byrne, Ross Byrne. Ross is just, you know, he doesn't make too many mistakes. He kicks his goals. He's fairly reliable. But that running game, you know, getting that tempo up, I think Jack Carty has a little bit more. And unfortunately for me, I haven't seen enough of Harry Byrne. I think, you know, I know Dricko has been on the show a lot, singing his praises and banging the drum for him. But we just haven't seen enough of it. And, you know, I've been commentating on games where Harry Byrne's supposed to start, and then all of a sudden he's out in the warm-up and, you know, he maybe gets an injury 10 minutes into the game and he's off, and just, you know, a little bit unlucky here and there. So we might see a bit more of him over the Christmas period in a Leinster jersey. But for me, Jack Carty is certainly Ireland's number two at the minute. The way he's playing, it's brilliant to watch.
Yeah, we'll have to wait until later in the week to get the team selections for this weekend. And always with the URC, so much, Stephen, comes down to what kind of team is fielded, particularly by the away team this time of year. So it's very hard to actually make a prediction for this weekend. But are you hopeful that Ulster get a victory against Connacht and crucially kind of keep ground with Leinster in the URC towards the top of the table as well?
Yeah, I think, you know, Ulster with the two home games over the next, over on Boxing Day and New Year's Day. You know, I personally feel that Leinster are going to come up the road with a stronger team, and you know they wouldn't have been happy being beaten at the RDS, but by Ulster, and probably convincingly enough in the end, Ulster were by far the better side in that game. So yeah, I know we always said about Connacht, that bogey team, potential banana skin for Ulster, but at home, Christmas derby, you know, the fans there, good atmosphere. You would expect Ulster to win this game, but I certainly feel it's going to be very, very tight, but very entertaining at the same time because both sides like to throw it around. So, yeah, I'm going to go for an Ulster win this weekend, and you know, I'll wait until I see the team sheet for the Ulster-Leinster game in 10 days' time.
Just on the final note before we let you go, I was just thinking this is a slight advantage Ulster are going to have over the next couple of weeks because of the nature of restrictions. Like, it's very unfortunate for Munster, Connacht particularly, who will have sold a lot of tickets ahead of the festive fixtures, that outdoor events in the Republic are now down to 5,000 for, you know, outdoor rugby. So therefore, it's going to have a financial impact, Stephen, on the three provinces south of the border, because this was a time when they were just making a little bit of money back after 2 years of money leaking. And now these would have been fixtures where they would have sold a lot of tickets and probably brought in quite a bit of their money for the year with the Interpro derbies over the Christmas period.
Ach, lads, it's a mess. It's a mess. And it's really disappointing. And especially around the Christmas period, everybody's excited. You know, sometimes, as you both know, that this is the only time of the year that, you know, rugby fans might go to a game. You know, you have your diehard fans that go every single week and support the club, you know, whatever time of the year it is. But you have your fans that just come for the odd game over Christmas or the odd knockout game, and they're the ones that bring in the revenue. They bring in the money, and down to 5,000, the lack of atmosphere. You know, you've heard it before about the players, about it being almost soul destroying, going out and running out to play a really important fixture, and there being nobody there, or little to nobody there. And that's hugely disappointing. You know, Wales as well. You know, you got to think about the other teams in the URC, the Welsh regions. There's going to be, you know, closed doors now for their games. I was chatting to Tom Shanklin about Cardiff, and they played a game against, who did they have? They had Toulouse. And, you know, the amount of money that generated for the club, it was just extraordinary. And they really needed that bit of a bump, bit of a financial bump, and they got that, and what a great game it was too. I know Toulouse ran out worthy winners, but it was a brilliant atmosphere, and it seemed to be like rugby was back, and now all of a sudden the rug has been pulled out beneath us once again. So yeah, very, very frustrating, a little bit disheartening for me, working on the games and going to the games and commentating. I'm sure it takes away from the lads, the adrenaline, getting up for it. Like, it also takes away from me working on the games as well. So yeah, but here it is what it is at the minute. Everybody's health is the number one priority, of course, and hopefully in the next couple of weeks we can put this behind us and continue to move in a more positive direction.
Stephen, thanks a million for joining us on OTBAM.
Cheers, lads.
Looking forward to those games this coming weekend. Of course, Brian O'Driscoll, if you go to the OTB Sports app tomorrow, you'll be able to hear his preview of the festive fixtures, including Leinster's trip to Munster, which we'll talk about in more detail later on in the week as well. But that's a look ahead to Connacht against Ulster at Kingspan Stadium on St. Stephen's Day. And you also have Munster against Leinster at Thomond Park as well. Let's have a look then, coming up at 27 minutes before 9 o'clock at the back pages. Understandably, we'll start with OTB sports.com this morning. Again, stories really dominated around the Premier League situation, and that's reflected across the back papers today as well, that the Premier League season is going to continue on. You get your American football fix on otbsports.com as well, and if you want to sign up for the gridiron for more details ahead of the college football games, you can do so there as well. Back of the newspapers then, starting with the Sun, Spurs get Euro boot is from from yesterday, confirmation from UEFA that there's no time to refix Wren against Spurs, which means that Tottenham's time in the Conference League has come to an end. Manchester United and Edison Cavani is on the back page of The Sun as well. Plenty of reports in Spain over the last 48 hours or so that Barcelona are looking to sign Edison Cavani, but with their financial situation, they would need Manchester United to release him from his contract 6 months early. But indications on the report here from Martin Blackburn are that Manchester United want to try and keep Edison Cavani until next summer. He's missed a host of fixturing, 10 games out with tendonitis at the start of this season. It's been an injury hit start to the year. We also see Adama Traore, the former Barcelona and now Wolves player, getting his booster shot. We're talking about Premier League earlier with Colm, and crucially, the Premier League saying yesterday that over 80% of the players in the league are now on what they called the vaccine journey, and over 77% of them have now received both doses of the jab, and many are being encouraged to take the boosters as well. So it's been a huge increase from the 68% in October who had received both jabs at that point. But no rest, ye weary gentlemen. Premier clubs decide to power on. That was the decision made at the meeting of the Premier League teams yesterday. In the Irish Star today, Mona's delight, Mona McSherry, on the back of the Star with her bronze medal, which was picked up yesterday. Colm Mullany will be talking more about the World Swimming Championships in Abu Dhabi, but a new Irish record set by Sligo's Mona McSherry in winning bronze in the 100 metres breaststroke final. Time of 103.92 was a new Irish record, which was set in the semi-final. Also, you can see Derek Foley's story on the back of the Star as well, with the Irish women's rugby team, their players meeting with government ministers, what's kind of become a listening period for them, really, where they're going to have more talks now with the RFU. Ciara Griffin saying there were constructive talks that were held yesterday about the future of Irish women's rugby. And again, play on is the story. Green light for COVID-hit Premier League to continue with FA Cup replays scrapped for round 3 and 4. And Gideon Brooks' story on the back of the Star is Pep, you'll obey my orders. That's about Phil Foden and Jack Grealish, who went to a nightclub after Man City's 7-0 win against Leeds, and they were dropped from the squad entirely for the fixture against Newcastle, which was won by Man City at the weekend. Taking a look then at the Guardian at the back page today, restrictions for on-jab players being considered. The Premier League are also going to be releasing details every month about the amount of players who've been vaccinated within the league from next season. And Root blasts England's bowlers after latest defeat. It's been a miserable start for England's cricketers in the Ashes series against Australia. Australia very much on top after the first couple of test matches, and Joe Root there with a cap over his head after that match. Moving on then to the Irish Independent, Gerry Thornley, who we'll hear from a little bit later on the programme, was on Monday Night Rugby last night, is writing about Leinster's appeal against the 28-0 loss that was inflicted on them against Montpellier last Friday, and when that game didn't go ahead. There's plenty of preview on the rugby about Ulster against Connacht, which you just talked about with Stephen Ferris, and also player representatives called for genuine culture change in the RFU, as Johnny Waterson's story coming off the back of those meetings between the Irish players and ministers. And respect match officials have always enjoyed is being chipped away is an opinion piece by Owen Doyle on the back of the Irish Times sports section today. And we saw particularly, we talked about in the GA show with Tommy Rooney last week, issues with the scenes at the end of the Mount Belly Moylock game against Pádraig Pearse's in the Connacht Club Senior Football Championship, where the referee was surrounded by players and hands were put on the referee after Pádraig Pearse's controversial 1-point win in that one. In the Irish Examiner today, which is on the inside of the Examiner, proposal B and discussions around maybe some finessing of the ideas which we saw last weekend that are going to now go forward towards Congress. Potentially points will be given for the league winners in the championship to try and get those proposals over the line. You'll remember the special Congress narrowly voted in favour of proposal B coming in, but not enough to meet the 60% which is required for a rule change. Those ideas have been a bit finessed, and there's more writing about that from John Fogarty in the Irish Examiner today. Also in the Herald Sports today, Mona McSherry takes their back banner as well, bronze medal for McSherry in Abu Dhabi. We'll be taking a look at that in the sports news with Carl in just a few moments' time. The Premier show must go on with a picture of of a Chelsea fan in a mask outside Stamford Bridge. Clubs vote to continue season over Christmas despite outbreaks of COVID-19 in the UK. Dave Kelly also has a story about the fixtures changing in the URC for Leinster and Munster particularly. The reason for this, South African travel ban currently, which is playing absolute havoc with the United Rugby Championship going into this weekend and further on into the season. It's bronze and a record for Mona in Abu Dhabi, that semi-final Irish record for Mona McSherry in her bronze medal. And Premier League orders clubs to pick their under-21s. So no longer, you would think from this weekend particularly, will lobbying be allowed by clubs to say, we've got an outbreak of COVID-19 cases, therefore give us a chance not to play this weekend. And it may well be a case that players from your B team or your under-21s will have to come into Premier League sides to start. And Leopardstown go extra furlong for punters. Philip Quinn's story on the back of the Daily Mail this morning. Leopardstown will be lit up by the presence of 5,000 racegoers for their four-day Christmas festival meeting. Racegoers chiefs confirmed yesterday all advance tickets purchased by the public will be honoured across the 4 days. There was plenty of concern about that. And also Limerick Racing, which was selling out very quickly. Their big festive programmes for racecourses. And there was a worry that with attendances being cut back, that that would be a concern. Now, new Premier League fixtures dominating the sports headlines today, but vaccinated and unvaccinated players also a topic of discussion. Miguel Delaney was on OTB last night discussing just that. And here's what he had to say when he spoke to Owen.
A real issue in the Premier League is that a lot of players aren't getting vaccines because of what are frankly delusional theories going around the division, going around dressing rooms. Two of the most commonly repeated are, one, cardiac issues. So you hear Christian Eriksen's name brought up a lot by players. That's despite the fact that Inter confirmed he wasn't vaccinated. And last Monday, in an excellent column for the Irish Times, Ken Early cited that study, the doctor who did that study in Germany, which illustrated that 2021 has actually had fewer cardiac issues in football than the pre-COVID year of 2018. So that's one theory that explains his personal choice already demolished. The second one, which is even more bizarre, is lots of players think or have been told, or like, this is something swirling around, that taking the vaccine affects your virility, which is obviously it's just pure conspiratorial nonsense. And that is a challenge for the Premier League. It's something they're trying to tackle. And I think, depending how the situation goes, if Omicron, say, does calm down in a month, this again will be something that dissipates. But say if it does happen again, we have another variant that kind of rampages through the UK and causes problems for the Premier League, it will come up again and will be an ongoing issue.
All right, Miguel Delaney there in conversation on the football show last night with Owen. Carl Maloney is here with us to have a look at the sports headlines. How are you getting on this morning, Carl?
Morning, Will. How are you?
Well, look, as a man from Sligo, I'm sure you're very proud of Mona McSherry and her achievements in the pool over the last few days and bronze coming home.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Great swim yesterday. Another final to look forward to later today. She's made it through this morning to the 200 metres breaststroke final. So, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, there's probably a level of expectation on her shoulders to succeed. And definitely after the Olympics, her profile has gone up another couple of notches, but the performances that she continues to churn out and the amount of records that she's broken this week has been just amazing. So the trajectory she's on, if she can keep going that way, I think the sky's the limit. But let's see how she can do later on. Obviously, the 100 metres breaststroke is her preferred event, and that's what she medalled in yesterday, of course. But she's in the 200 metres event later today. Qualified in 7th place this morning from her heats. Niamh Coyne was 14th, and incidentally, McSherry broke Niamh Coyne's record in qualifying for the final. Her final this afternoon in Abu Dhabi at 20-3 or thereabouts Irish time. A couple of other finals as well, Will, this afternoon for Ireland to look forward to. At 5:02 our time, Daniel Whiffen goes in the 1500 metre freestyle final, and Jack McMillan is in the 100 metres freestyle final at 25-3. So all in all, I think it's fair to say a great week for Ireland.
Yeah, it's been a fantastic start. What else has happened this morning, Cole?
In terms of football news, you've covered it already. The Premier League set to continue with its fixtures schedule despite a record high of COVID cases, 90 positive cases in the latest round of testing. And it's also been revealed that 23% of players aren't double vaccinated against COVID-19, while 16% are yet to have their first jab. The World Cup, every 2 years, might it happen? Well, countries would vote in favour of it, according to the FIFA president, Gianni Infantino. He says a biennial staging of the tournament would be approved approved if a snap vote was called. Member associations were informed yesterday that such a change would increase revenue by over €3 billion. Manchester City players Phil Foden and Jack Grealish have been warned about their behaviour after they reportedly turned up to training in poor condition. A picture has emerged appearing to show them on a night out last Tuesday. The England pair were then dropped from the starting lineup for Sunday's Premier League win at Newcastle, and boss Pep Guardiola has said that it wasn't a case of rotation. Some action on the field this evening. In the Carabao Cup, Arsenal take on League One Sunderland. That's a quarter-final tie at the Emirates from 7:45. The other three last eight ties take place tomorrow evening. In darts, there'll be a second-round meeting of two former winners at the PDC World Darts Championship. Raymond van Barneveld is set to meet Rob Cross after his win at the Alexandra Palace last night. Later today, Irish interest because Steve Lennon's third-round opponent will be confirmed this evening. The Carlo native will play the winner of the clash between Mervyn King and Ryan Joyce. And finally, Will, I suppose worrying news from the UK that all sporting events in Wales will now be played behind closed doors from St Stephen's Day. That's to help control the spread of COVID-19. It follows a steep rise in cases across the country due to the Omicron variant, so possibly a sign of things to come.
Carl, you were having a look as well about the championship proposals, and effectively a new review group were put together after Special Congress to try and get proposals on the table for Congress in February. So it's a pretty quick turnaround, but the agenda was felt that was there by the GAA's top brass after the conversations that happened at Special Congress. A and B has now been replaced by green and red, effectively. And again, we see in the Irish Examiner today the idea, maybe some of these kind of small changes and tweaks that are being made, the idea that, you know, potentially provincial winners might get a couple of points in a league-based championship, which might help to get this over the line. Like, ultimately, to try and convince that 49 and a bit percent that didn't vote for a change with Proposal B, this is what we're going to see over the next few weeks, are probably just small changes, Carl, I would think, to try and get this over the line.
Yeah, I think so, Will. As you say, it's in the Irish Examiner this morning. I like the look of the green option as well, to be honest, but I think the red option is probably it's closer to Proposal B, isn't it? So that's the one that they'll probably be looking at getting over the line. Yeah, I mean, there's a huge swell of support for change in some shape or form, and the general consensus was maybe it just needed a little bit more time just to finesse some certain parts of Proposal B. I do think it is quite a quick turnaround, but I do think possibly the small little tweaks and the linking of the provincial series to a championship series in terms of points and stuff, as you mentioned, might be enough to sway the counties that maybe were in doubt. But there's definitely an urge and a need now to have some sort of change, and possibly that will be increased by this year's championship when it's more or less reverted to the old format. Now, whether obviously that's going to take place after this is debated again, but it'll probably show again the inconsistencies with the current format. So I do think there will be change in some shape or form, and the red option at the moment, I think, looks to be the chief among them. So let's see what happens. But it's going to be interesting. And I guess if Proposal B had gone through, wouldn't we be so excited now, approaching the new year with a new championship format on the horizon, even though we are excited about the new GAA season, of course, in its current format. But I think it would give a new added life to the football championship, definitely.
Yeah, I think so. I think eventually the idea of having it in a league-based format and where teams play against sides at their own level, personally, I wasn't a huge fan of the idea of effectively breaking off Division 1 and Division 2 from the rest of the group to a certain extent, which would copper fasten maybe some of the best teams. And yeah, like, understand me, the TV companies and sponsors would want to be attached to the very top two divisions of any league format, but already those kind of discrepancies exist. It's not something that you can remove overnight anyway. So
yeah,
intriguing to see how they change it.
Yeah, I think as well, as you mentioned, kind of siphoning off the Division 1 and Division 2 teams from Division 3 and 4 teams. I think if you went around the Division 3 and 4 teams and asked the players and those panels what they would like, possibly close to the top of the list would be more opportunities to play the better teams, because their argument would be that they haven't, you know, if they get there once or twice a year in the provincial championship against a Dublin, a Mayo, a Galway, a Kerry and Munster, a Tyrone and Ulster, that it's not enough. But when they do play that match, that it's worth four or five matches against maybe equal opposition in terms of learning where they can improve, shows where their pitfalls are. And that's why I know there are some advocates out there for a return to the National League format the way that it was with Divisions 1A and 1B and 2A and 2B, where teams maybe of a lower level got to exposure to some of the better teams in that format, and that kind of gave them a little bit of a boost in terms of playing that caliber of opposition and gave them a little bit of a lift. So retention of the provincial championship in that case would give teams a chance still to play the better teams at some stage of the year and maybe a chance to get a real morale-boosting win or at least a good performance that can boost them going forward. And I think they need that little bit of a carrot as well in terms of getting the opportunity to have a crack at the top teams and see what they're made of.
Just before I let you go, are you a fan of the darts? Like the idea of the returning Barney going up against Crossy is interesting.
Yeah. No, I am a fan of the darts. I certainly got into it in the mid-noughties. Was it Barney and Taylor, that great final, was the one that kind of reeled me in. It's part of Christmas now, really, isn't it? I mean, it's part of like the rugby and the football. It's nearly part of Christmas now. Obviously, Taylor's moved off the stage. Michael van Gerwen still looks like the main man. Peter Wright has been great value for entertainment in recent years as well. Gary Anderson, I was a fan of Gary's as well for a while. But it is a great event, I think, you know, in terms of what they've done with darts to popularise it. And such a competitive sporting environment is brilliant. And obviously the Premier League has done really, really well as well. And we had the event in Dublin. It was the World Grand Prix that used to be in Dublin as well. Yeah. That used to attract big crowds. So, no, it's fantastic and great to have it to watch over the Christmas.
Yeah, absolutely. You used to love going to City West or when it was in the Point or the Three Arena, as they call it these days, when the Premier League came across to Dublin as well. Carl, thanks a million for joining us on OTBM this morning.
Thanks, lads.
Colm, something totally different I want to ask you about is Keane and Richards back on the road again. You picked this out last night when we were chatting, and I'm guessing this is something you're going to sit down to watch when it goes up on YouTube, right?
Part one of three went up last night. It's a pity Cahill Milani's leaving. I'd say he's a big Mickey Richards Roy Keane man. I'll be asking him about that now. But, like, it's so funny with Roy. He resists all these things, you know. He's always asked to do these things, and yet he keeps on doing them. You know, like, he keeps on showing up. So I don't know if he really just loves Mickey Richards or if he just loves the opportunity, if you know what I mean, to do these shows repeatedly. And maybe it's the latter, but it's to our entertainment anyway. But there does seem to be a genuine rapport between the two of them.
I think they genuinely like each other. I think that chemistry is the force. I think that's genuine.
No, they like each other. I think they're going to have to do the big road trip. Like, they could do their own version of Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon's The Trip, and it could be real. It could actually happen. But they're going to have to do it quick, because I have a feeling that people are going to get sick of them if they continue to do these little bits. I feel like they're going to have to go all out for a series, and I would definitely watch that. If that was on Netflix, I would say it would be the number one in Ireland.
It would go really well, but the Sky executives would never allow their two pundits to stand up on Netflix. That would end up being a Sky One series.
I'm just thinking that, yeah. But I mean, and the age difference between them too, like, you know, they have different interests, and yet they've come together. And I guess Mickey brings out the smiling Roy. And isn't that all we want to see?
Oh, yeah. Look, I think Roy Keane, since he joined Instagram, and I was delighted that Paul Lambert confirmed to me at one point that it is legitimately Roy Keane. His daughter may well have set up the account, but Roy Keane is deciding what goes up on the account. So I did worry for a while that maybe this could be, you know, Mika Richards setting this up or one of his family doing it. But no, I think legitimately Roy Keane, the pictures and stuff that he's sticking up on Instagram are him. And it's just given us a totally different way into Roy Keane. Looking at some of the comments, as the philosopher Superhands once said, sometimes they're good comments on YouTube. Dar O'Toole in contact. Surely unvaccinated players should be removed to keep the COVID disruption and threat down to keep the league going. I don't know, Dara. The thing is, people who've been vaccinated can still catch and spread COVID-19. Obviously, you reduce the risk of illness and transmission if you've had vaccines and boosters, but it gets into serious territory if you start excluding players who've made the decision not to get vaccinated for COVID-19. And just look at the standoff there has been between Joshua Kimmich and Bayern Munich over the last month, where their relationship has really broken down because Kimmich decided not to take the vaccine. Same with Choupo Moting, who've missed quite a bit of football over the last month as well. Gav Salesman contact. Should be easy enough to extend the end of the season by 2 or 4 weeks. The World Cup next December will change it up as well. I think if the World Cup doesn't move, that's going to make it very difficult to get an off-season completed and then to be back out for an early start, because Colm, the plan at the moment is that the teams are going to be back out first week of August. It's actually a really early start to get these 18 rounds of games in.
Yeah, so that's the Premier League season starting early August and the Community Shield's a week earlier. So you could be looking like, geez, the end of July when it gets real competitive. I mean, usually you're talking about European qualifiers that time of year, but we could become quite competitive quite early next season. But it goes back to my point, Will, like, are these players going to stop caring eventually because they have just too much work to do and the joy is gone? I mean, they're pretty well remunerated for the joy to remain, but I don't know. They're human beings still.
Yeah. Also, Sean Lynch in contact on our YouTube at Off the Ball. Great to see the entire Wolves players and staff get their boosters together yesterday. Yeah, we saw the picture of Adama Traore in the back of the newspapers and promoting it on social media. Mm. Need more of this from Sean. Continue to get in contact. You can tweet us as well at Off the Ball if you want to get in on the conversation around the show on OTBAM. Now it's 7 minutes before 9 o'clock. It is time for us to chat to Paul Kilgannon. His new book is out, Journaling to Be the Best You Can Be in Sport. Paul is a sports coach working with teenage athletes at local hurling club in Carnmore in Galway, as well as being a coaching consultant. We spoke to Paul last summer as part of our Future of Sport series, and delighted to say that he's here with us. He's also the creator of the Carver Coaching Framework. Paul, how are you getting on this morning?
Good, lads. Thanks. Happy to be here.
Yeah, well, look, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year in advance. Now, people are probably thinking, Paul, about what they can do in the new year, and you've been writing about the benefits of, you know, journaling, keeping accountable to what you want to achieve in a week, and also, I guess, making time to actually sit down and plan things out.
Yeah, I think, I suppose, throughout my adult life, I've been trying to help athletes and coaches find the best way and to provide resources for athletes to achieve their best. And I've often found that, like, everyone wants to be good and everyone wants to win, but it's knowing how to do it and the best ways to do it and providing the supports and resources is the challenge. So I have long espoused the value of journaling for improved sporting performance. And I wrote a book last year, Be the Best You Can Be in Sport, which provided a lot of the information that you might need. But I think there's a missing piece there in the ability to process that information and to figure out what it means to you and how you want to represent yourself in sport and in the various elements of preparation in sport. So what I tried to do was produce a resource for them so that they could journal and reflect and I suppose be introspective on certain elements that will drive performance and then provide, I suppose, a framework or, I suppose, a process where they can be true to that and learn as they go. So that's what I try to do.
I was reading about Dan Carter speaking about this on a podcast recently too, and he was making the point that he took this up as part of his career as a rugby player, and it's something that he's carried into life after sport too. And he said that one of the great benefits that he found from actually journaling what he was doing and what he wanted to achieve and reflecting on maybe, you know, good and bad points during the week is that he wouldn't then just cruise from day to day. Like, he even plans his days off now in life beyond sport because he feels it's important to actually sit down, work out what he wants to achieve, give himself a bit of thanks for what he achieves along the way, and also to chart the learnings and maybe things he wasn't expecting along the way too. He's found it valuable even beyond sport to do this.
Yeah, I suppose there's a phrase I think I've heard before, getting better at getting better is a phrase. And you'll find even the research will tell us this, all the high performers, they're better at plan, do, review, and they're better at being really clear in how they want to behave. So giving themselves that space, I think in that podcast, he said he takes a half an hour on a Sunday to plan out his week ahead. And he's very clear on his purpose when he was a player. So he's really clear to be a great All Black. And he was, I think, I was listening to the same podcast. He was very clear on his personal truths. I think a personal truth he had was good enough isn't good enough, be the best. And how that shaped his behaviours thereafter. He talked about, you know, the realisation of his purpose was to be a great All Black, and that drove all his behaviours thereafter. And that's, I suppose, the power of journaling. It gives you that time to sit down, ask yourself deep questions, draw your personal truths, draw clarity, and from that insight, then drive informed actions and maybe figure out who you need to get to help you, certain things like that, so you actually get better at getting better in a very systematic, structured way. And excellence is quite rare, so it's rare for people to do this, you know. And sometimes I say I write books called Be the Best You Can Be in Sport, not Be Average or whatever, you know. So there is a cost, but it's definitely worth it, I would believe. We spend an awful lot of time training and preparing, and I think there seems to be a huge gap in, we'll say, delivering their potential for all the inputs. And I think this is part of that gap.
The honesty that a player has to show to actually find that driving force as well. We keep Barry on a couple of weeks ago talking about his work with Keith Earls, and he was saying it took a couple of meetings with Keith to work out exactly what he wants to achieve. And then that one singular goal that Keith Earls wanted to achieve, he wanted to be the Irish player's player of the year the next season. And that was going to be his one driving goal. So every little small incremental thing that he did along the way was to try and be the best Irish rugby player for the next season. But he said at the start, that was something that he had to work with Keith for a while, was to work out what the actual driving force was. Because for an athlete, they might have various different things that they want to achieve. It might be to try and get Munster to a trophy. It might be to try and get Ireland to win something. It might be to get in the team, to not make mistakes. It probably takes a little bit of introspective thought to work out exactly what the player is driving for here.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, good thinking requires time. And we're time poor a lot of the time because there's so much information and context shifting coming at us all the time. So that's what journaling provides. It provides that time, that golden time to sit down and to gather your thoughts and then review them and keep reviewing them and refining them. And that's, as far as I can see, through 20 years of dealing with all athletes of all ages, all abilities, that's what I see as the missing parts. They don't, I suppose, there's a phrase, know me, be me, stay me. And, you know, to be yourself, you have to know yourself. And then to stay yourself under pressure and stress in competition, you have to really know yourself. So you will find that an awful lot of the high performers will, it'll sound really, really simple, but I think simplicity is the highest form of complexity. So they have simplified it, and not oversimplified it, which some people confuse it by, but they have simplified it through so much process of self-reflection. Now, a lot of these professional athletes have professional supports to help them get there to that deep meaning. I have heard a performance psychologist who says, I spend the first 2 years working with an athlete on identity. And then performance is just expressing that identity, you know, in a cool, collected way, because you know yourself so well, and that the performance arena isn't a place for anxiety there. It's a place for, I suppose, enjoyment. And if you go back to Dan Carter, the last phrase he would write in his journal before performance was enjoy. And I think sometimes we look at that superficially. We don't look at it at a deep enough level. It's that my understanding of it would be, because a lot of people throw that out, just enjoy it. But how can you enjoy it if you're not poorly, if you're poorly prepared? How can you enjoy it if you're under stress, anxious? You can't. So the enjoyment only comes from the preparation and then looking forward to presenting this preparation at a high level.
Something I thought was very interesting about Carter too, Paul, was that he mentioned the fact that he also had to try and plan for the bits of his week which were away from sport too, because he was pointing out that maybe 4 or 5 days he's got gym program, he's taken on all this information from coaches along the way, doing his individual bits of training as well, and the focus is hugely on rugby for the vast majority of his week. But he also had to kind of allocate space where he could think about not playing the game and also to be able to enjoy life a bit away from it too. I guess finding that balance is probably important if you're doing your journaling and actually planning out your week as well.
Yeah. So sometimes they call that athletic identity foreclosure, where you just look at yourself as completely just as an athlete and no other parts of your life are developed. And really, it's a narrow lens to look at. So I think a lot of the All Blacks and Carter particularly, they're very clear on that. This is a small part, but a really important part of who we are. So if you look at the way I set up the journal, I put a kind of there's a 9-day This Is Me challenge to begin with. So there's eight topics I've asked them to journal for 30 minutes on. The first one is what sport means to me. So understanding the why, understanding what you want to achieve from it, what it means to yourself, those around you. And then we move into self-identity and personal truths. And in that identity piece, we look at the different roles and, you know, being maybe a husband, being a son, being an employee, being a student, all the different roles. And then we look at the truths for life, or what you know for sure. And then day three moves on to character and values, and creating kind of personal mission statements about how you want to behave. And then day four looks at, I'm trying to look at the whole gambit of performance. What type of teammate you want to be, and what are exceptional, acceptable and unacceptable behaviors for a teammate, getting real clarity there. And then day five, we go on to kind of your ability to learn, coachability and the learner's mindset. And I suppose being that student of the game and that student of performance, that learning piece. Then six, we talk about application to training. I think on day seven, then we talk about time and energy management, planning out is how you're spending your time and your energy true to your values and your identity. Are you putting all your time into one area and not enough into developing the other areas, the more rounded athlete? And then day eight, I look at excellence, success and commitment and defining them things for themselves. And then on day nine, we summarize the whole 8 days of 30 minutes a day, which is tough. I understand that. I don't apologize for that. On the ninth day, then they come up with a This Is Me summary, which summarizes the eight previous days. And then the next 21 days in the journal are how can we deliver or work towards that. So the Sunday is 30 minutes of planning. Then the weekdays are morning and evening journaling. And then the Saturday is a reflection piece. And all the time we're setting goals and we're metric tracking in the 21 days. So how much time am I actually spending on things that are important to my life outside of sport? And because to be applying yourself, we need intensity. And it's very hard to sustain intensity if we don't get away from things. So what I've tried to do in the journal is create that type of a framework or a structure or a process for the athletes to really build out the behaviours that can drive, informed action and self-reflection and learning as they go.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of self-reflection and introspection probably required along the way over the 4 weeks or so that they're going to be journaling here initially if they follow along your path. Is this something that's actually accessible to all athletes or the vast majority of athletes, though? If they sit down and actually give the time to it, can this be achieved by pretty much anyone in sport?
Yeah, I think it requires discipline, you see. And I suppose there's a phrase there, everybody wants to win, but not everybody wants to prepare in order to be good enough to win or be prepared enough to win. So there is that self-discipline piece. And all too often, I think we undervalue excellence or we undervalue craft and things like that. So everyone can try, and I really hope everyone has the capacities to do it. It won't suit everyone at certain stages of their life and that thing, but it's there for everyone. Performance is always available. Performance is always available for everyone. So I try to make resources that would be suitable for a professional and someone who mightn't, you know, be obsessed by this. So I would like to think it's doable for everybody. I would like to think it's a tool that can be used by many. And I would like to think that it's a tool that can help everyone. That would be my hope anyways.
And I would imagine as well, Paul, if you get into this journey, and particularly if you get over the first 8 or 9 days and you've set out your goals and you've written all this down, you're in all likelihood probably going to follow through for the 3 weeks that go, because you've already invested so much, you've already written this down, you've already made yourself accountable. You're probably going to follow on with the process more than if you weren't actually writing this down. It's very easy, if we're not, to do what Carter said and to just kind of cruise. You could go, well, look, I did a week or so and I put all these goals down, I'm going to try and achieve as many as I possibly can. But when you've actually journaled to that point, you're probably more likely to follow on in the following weeks if you've started the process.
Yeah, that would be the hope. Yeah, I think, you know, what I'm trying to do in this is give a deep dive into it. Obviously, day-to-day journaling for an athlete isn't as complex as that. But I think, you know, they say too smart, Latin, hybrid. A good start is really important, you know. So that's what I try to do, front load it at the start. And then it's almost about kind of, you know, topping it up as they go along and tilting it and turning it. But there is an investment at the start, yeah, for sure. I don't apologize for that. I think if we look at the amount of time we spend, like, on, and we have to get our priorities right, the amount of time we're spending on the pitch, the amount of time athletes are spending in the gym, and then to think that it wouldn't, it would be, you know, a lot to ask to 10 or 15 minutes of sitting down and planning and thinking about it, you know, I don't think it's a big gap to think that that's a wise decision to make, you know.
Well, look, the book is Journaling to Be the Best You Can Be in Sport. It's written by Paul Kilgannon. Paul, thanks a million for joining us here on OTB AM.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, and just to end there, it's available on carvercoachingframework.com, and we have a coupon code there for OTB10 for anyone who wants to buy it. It's OTB10. It's a discount. So thanks, guys.
There you go. No excuse to get a bit cheaper before Christmas. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And OTB AM, it is coming up now on 9:06, is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Still to come, Monday Night Rugby at 9:30 is a discussion on last weekend's Champions Cup and the fallout from Leinster's appeal, which is still ongoing, against the decision to award the result against them against Montpellier. But up after the break, we'll be getting our teeth into the football news and the festive fixtures this weekend with Philip Egan. Oh, oh, oh. Oh, 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 oh.
OTB AM.
Welcome back to OTBM. It is time for us to chat about the festive football. Phil Egan is here with us. Phil, how are you getting on?
How are you doing, Will? How are you getting on?
Your reaction to the Premier League clubs, firstly, Phil, the decision that was made yesterday, like probably a million different pressures that were on around the TV contract, around trying to get things finished as early as possible this season because of the changes for next year. They were very unlikely to vote for a change, but were you surprised that no club was for the idea of a circuit break?
Well, I think Liverpool, from what I believe, were looking at getting one round of fixtures called off, but obviously the majority decided the show must go on. It's interesting what's happening in Wales. Obviously overnight it was announced from the 26th they're going behind closed doors. Now there's no Welsh clubs in the Premier League, obviously Swansea and Cardiff in the Championship, but it does have that sense that that's the next step, that the Premier League aren't the ones that are going to decide this. It's going to be the UK government. Now whether they go full on no fans or they reduce by 50%, the issue they have really probably isn't what's happening in the ground, happening inside the ground. It's getting the grounds, like whether you're on a tube or a bus and you're obviously mixing, because if you have say a 50% crowd, you can spread them out a bit. But it's going to be quite grim to watch.
It's really grim, Phil. Like, yeah, when things came back first, we were willing to accept the Premier League. And even the Bundesliga came back first, and there were empty grounds. There was a novelty value to it. Look, they're empty stadiums. We can hear the coaches shouting. And football is better than no football was the argument at the time.
The tactical insight of man on, man Cricket. On. Or yeah, no. And I remember when when the Bundesliga came back, obviously that was completely just no sound. Then obviously they decided to bring in some crowd noise and the novelty of hearing somebody press the button too early or the ball hits the side net and you hear a crowd cheer and you're like, it didn't actually go in. But then gradually, as you saw towards the end of last season, where crowds were coming in, and then remember the FA Cup final, you got a big crowd for that with Leicester and Chelsea. Remember, like, you think of Yuri Tielemans' goal into the back of the net, but also the crowd behind get to celebrate it. Then the Euros, it went to a different level at the Euros. The places like Budapest were full crowds, and I mean, look, some of the people in that crowd weren't the most weren't the nicest people, but the atmosphere was electric. Then Wembley obviously got bigger crowds. So to take it all away now, we've had a little bit of an experience of it in the last few weeks. Remember the Netherlands-Norway World Cup qualifier, which was a really important game with it, on the final night of qualifiers. Then you had the Bayern Munich and Barcelona game, again an important game in the context of who qualified from that group in the Champions League. City played behind closed doors away to Leipzig, and it was a tough watch because it's soulless without fans. And I said, we accepted it at the start when it was a case of, it was deemed Project Restart, but I don't know how many people might just be turned off by this. And look, there's a reason it's happening. You know, as I said, it's grim in terms of what's happening around the UK, around Ireland, with the amount of cases and people in hospital. So I get why it could happen, but I think it'll turn a lot of people off. Maybe they'll just decide, you know what, maybe I'll watch a film on Netflix rather than watch a game behind closed doors.
Yeah, Bill, speaking of entertainment, do you know what? Producer Enda has just told me today is the 25th anniversary of Eric Cantona's chip against Sunderland. And my question to you, is that the greatest celebration in Premier League history?
Well, I think of even going back to, remember Bruno Fernandes scored that goal against Everton and they tried to split screen it.
It's pretty similar, but not quite the same.
Well, he didn't go for it properly.
Yeah, but the difference as well, again, is Bruno Fernandes did it in an empty stadium when there was no one there to see it, whereas Cantona, obviously, you know, it helps as well. That was a United team in their pomp, and yeah, the celebration of it. Yeah, it's up there. Like, I don't know how you feel about, I was looking at even a couple of weeks ago when Leicester scored against Newcastle, Patson Daka, the somersaults, they're pretty impressive. I mean, a lot can go wrong with that, potential cruciate injury, but Cantona kept it quite simple, but at the same time it was very effective.
Is it because, lads, it's so quintessential Cantona as well, in that I think most footballers would have went for power as opposed to finesse with the shot in the first place, and then it's just Cantona's nonchalant, incredibly French, incredibly Cantona celebration afterwards. Like, it's an iconic moment because it's Cantona, Colin.
Well, no, like, we've seen that goal scored before. Like, he scored a better chip than that away to Sunderland, I think it was. Or was it Sheffield United? It was one of the two. It was a better chip. And then it was like a touch and body against Crystal Palace at Selhurst Park. He scored better goals than that. But yeah, it's a celebration. And the camera caught it perfectly. And, you know, in the subsequent years, players tried to repeat it. And now Cantona, to a certain extent, has cashed in on that persona that he built back in the 90s. But it was amazing at the time. Like, you have the subtlety and nonchalance of Cantona, and then you have the in-your-face celebration of, do you remember Shefki Kuchi?
Oh,
remember,
yes.
He used to just jump and just land on his chest with gay abandon. No problem to it at all.
The late Jimmy McGee, remember when Shefki Kuchi scored a goal? He gave it the old Coochie Coochie Coo.
See, Jimmy always knew the right moments. Yeah. Jimmy knew just to keep quiet during the Maradona goal. Just a few words were enough to actually enhance the experience around that. But yeah, I think it is one of the great celebrations. I think it's one of the great Premier League goals as well. It's the reason Oisín McConville, when he played for Armagh, whenever they had collars on their shirts and same across McLean, he wore it up because of Eric Cantona. We did a couple of years before Oisín broke through into the first team. Put the collar up, show that bit of personality when you're playing. It's something we kind of missed to a certain extent, Colm. It's not like... That kind of personality that Cantona had is one of the reasons that, like, he goes beyond a cult hero because he's one of the best players in Premier League history, but he's remembered so fondly because he was such an icon of the Premier League at a time when I think a lot of people were probably getting into football post Euro 96 especially.
Yeah, they really cashed in on the characters in the 90s. Like, it's so interesting with Cantona, you'd wonder, like, what would he be like nowadays if he played? Would he be able to keep up with the pace of the game? I just don't know. You presume he'd adapt a bit, but... You know, there's kind of a lot said about we've kind of lost the characters in the game. I don't know if that's true. I mean, you still have someone like Jamie Vardy who loves winding up crowds, like when he did the Eagle celebration at Selhurst Park against Crystal Palace. Like, I love that. And I wish players did it more as well, because it is essentially entertainment at the end of the day. But yeah, I do miss the likes of Cantona and Vinnie Jones in the 90s. But, you know, the sacrifice is that the football is so much better now. You know,
yeah.
So it's probably the best ever football we've ever seen. Like, this season is probably the highest quality Premier League season, especially at the top of the table. Maybe we've lost a bit of character as a result, but it's probably better now. But I miss like a celebration routine, which you don't really see that much of now.
You think of Robbie Keane with his cartwheel and his forward roll?
Yeah, you don't see that much of it anymore. But like, I suppose it's all about the team now. Do you know, Pep Guardiola and Jurgen Klopp have brought it in. It's all about the team. Doesn't matter who's in or who's out. You score a goal, everybody celebrates together. Back to the halfway line, we go again. It's a bit monotonous, I don't know, but the football is the best it's ever been. Where do you stand on that, Phil? Where do you think the quality of the Premier League is the best it's ever been this season?
Yeah, do you know what? It can be said for so many sports. We hear it with so many sports where, you know, there's not enough characters in the game. But I would prefer... The higher standard where, yeah, I think the football is phenomenal. The pace it's been played at. And that's why I think it might suffer over the festive period where you look at those fixtures on the 26th and, yeah, it's great where you roll out of bed on the 26th and you've got Leeds and Liverpool at 12:30 and you think, yeah, I'll have a bit of that. But then the game's on the 28th. How... can these players get themselves back up and play at that same intensity? It's just not possible. It was years ago, but the game is just played at a ferocious pace now, and that means that players are going to suffer injuries. So the team selections you're going to see in the 26th and 28th are probably going to be very different, provided it all goes ahead. But as I said, kind of watch that space in terms of what they do with the crowds, whether they're going to be there. I hope if they do decide that they do it early, that there's not fans on their way to stadiums and then they're told to turn back around, especially if you've got a long trip. I know they try and do it on the 26th. They try and make it as close as possible geographically in the Premier League.
Yeah, but like, even if you're, say, a fan of Watford who's made the trip up to the West Midlands for the game against Wolves, and you find out an hour before kickoff that the game's been called off the day after Christmas when you've gotten your car and made that trip, it'd be an awful pain if the game was called off at that stage. The fixture's on St. Stephen's Day. We'll have live commentary and off the ball at Man City against Leicester, but you've got Liverpool against Leeds 12:30, same time is Wolves and Watford, Burnley versus Everton at 3, you've got Man City Leicester, Norwich against Arsenal, Spurs and Crystal Palace London derby, you've got West Ham against Southampton, Aston Villa versus Chelsea is the tea time game at 5:30. And the game you won't be able to watch in the pub because they'll be closed at 8 p.m. is Brighton against Brentford. And maybe not the most attractive fixture of the weekend anyway. But Phil, Chelsea, they've gone off the boil a little bit, haven't they? Like, this is now just 3 wins in their last 8 in the Premier League. They're 6 behind City. The wheels come off a little bit in the last month for Thomas Tuchel's side.
I've never really seen Chelsea as title contenders this season. I know what he did with them last season was brilliant and set them up so hard to beat, and they won the Champions League. But I've always just wondered what their plan is in attack. Now, they've got so many talented players that they can score goals, and obviously the wing backs have been chipping in with goals. Chilwell's gone at the moment. We know Alonso can still do it. Reece James is a phenomenal wing back. But just even watching them the other day, see, they've no Timo Werner, they've no Lukaku, and they just found it very hard to break Wolves down. They created one really good chance where Pulisic was denied by Sa, and the rest, even going back to the West Ham game, their first goal is a set piece. The second goal, because they have that quality, Mason Mount scored a brilliant volley where, you know, Ziyech just pings a ball across and Mount volleys it home. But I just feel that Tuchel, as good a manager as he is, I just don't think he's in the same league as the likes of Klopp and Guardiola. And how can he get that unit to be cohesive, that attacking unit? Because they have been so good defensively, they obviously don't lose many games, but now they're starting to concede goals. I know there's been a lot of credit given to Edouard Mendy. I think a decent keeper, but I still have question marks about him, especially just his decision making. I think he's an excellent shot stopper, but I worry about him when he comes off his line. I worry about him when he has the ball at his feet. I don't know if he's going to be around in January, because obviously we don't know about the AFCON. We would imagine it's going to be called off, but we still haven't heard anything yet. Maybe they know, but they're trying to keep it as close to their chest as possible.
And the organisers are pretty insistent that it is going to go ahead. It could be a game changer for some of the clubs, though, Phil.
It's a complete game changer.
Like Liverpool particularly, because on the face of it, it looked really messy for them, because there's South American qualifiers too. It looked like they were going to lose their Brazilian players for a few weeks and their African players would be away. If Sadio Mane and Mo Salah aren't travelling for international fixtures and the African Cup of Nations is lost, it changes Liverpool's outlook for January entirely.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's the... Personally, I would have picked City as title favourites at the start of the season. I know we did our predictions. I would have gone for City.
I have him here, Phil.
Yeah, I went City 1, I went Liverpool 2, Chelsea 3 and United 4.
Is you remember that right, Colm, if you have it in front of you?
I mean, that's impressive. But like, Phil, do you have that open ahead of you? Because this is written in August, but you're spot on. Would you stick with that?
I would stick with it, because obviously City are just starting to find their groove now. De Bruyne is back. If it goes behind closed doors, City, I think, are the best team to play football without fans. They can control games. They are very good even with hostile atmospheres away from home, of taking the sting out of a crowd, because they just keep the ball, and that's how they win games. They don't even need a number nine, a so-called number nine. So I think that was a pivotal day on Sunday. I did fear for Liverpool when I saw their midfield three. Just exactly, it reminded me a lot of last season, where obviously Van Dijk wasn't playing. Now Konate and Matip I thought were very good, but Spurs were able to bypass Liverpool's midfield and they found space, and that kind of just reminded me of last season, where Liverpool at the time were playing their best midfielders in central defence, and then they just weren't able to get the numbers in midfield to plug gaps, and teams were able to get at them. I think if Liverpool don't lose Mane and Salah to the AFCON in January, they have a chance, but I do expect them to finish strongly. The way I kind of feel is I think City are going to win the league, but I think Liverpool have a really good chance of winning the Champions League, because they will still be able to get themselves up for those big games on in European competition. They'll fancy their chances of beating Inter Milan. They would fancy their chances of beating Manchester City over two legs in a European knockout competition, especially if there is crowds at Anfield and at the Etihad. And we know what City are like in the Champions League. They just can't get the job done. They're very close to it. But I think hopefully Liverpool and Chelsea can stay in touch with City over the next few weeks, just to make it interesting in the second half of the season. But I do start to see Chelsea tail off.
Colin Buick, who was on your top four then when you were making these predictions? I know I was on holidays the week of this, so I can't be exposed.
Yeah, I can't find your name, Will. It's absent. I see, Will, I had a quiz for you. It was called How Well Do You Know Phil Egan?
Right.
And the first question was, who did Phil choose as his relegated three?
Ooh.
Will.
Let's see.
Look into Phil's eyes there now and see what he would say.
Now remember,
go on, Phil, did Norwich?
I got the three last season.
You did. You got
Sheffield United. You did.
You had them in the right order, so as well, said, as I recall.
Yeah, now I did pick Norwich, yeah.
Okay.
Norwich is one, yeah. Who are the other two?
Let's see. Burnley?
Think about this now.
I picked Burnley.
Oh, yeah, very good. Yeah. That was the left wing choice, I would say. And who's the right wing choice?
And then the third one. See, I'm thrown now by the table thinking about who's currently down there.
It was the same club he chose the first manager to go.
Oh.
Who would Phil Egan choose?
Watford?
Yeah.
Very good. You know Phil Egan well.
I think, you see, you gave it away because like everyone had to guess that Watford were going to dispense their manager before anyone else.
No, they didn't. There was only two or three people who guessed that. Yeah, I went Sean Dyche. I went way out there because I thought he was going to go. I was convinced.
Is that because of the contract issues last year, Colin?
Yeah, I was convinced. And I still had them to go down. And they might go down, but I really thought he'd go first. I thought Steve Bruce is too obvious, which was correct in saying that. But like Cisco Muniz, like you forget he was never manager of Watford at all. Watford is such an insane club.
I'd hate to do one of those Sporkle quizzes, Colin, where someone has like the Watford managers of the last 10 years and try and get every single one.
Oh, Jesus, yeah. Okay, so what was your question to me? Was it top four relegation?
Yeah, who did you pick for your top four?
So I went, I went first City. I went runners-up Chelsea. Don't know about that now. I went third ourselves. I went United. And I went fourth Liverpool. So my thinking there was that they were going to have a continuation of last season where they weren't as good as the year before. Which brings me to yourself, Phil. Is this your favourite version of Liverpool under Klopp, this season's team?
Yeah, and you know, I was in here last week and I was talking about how they can't cope without Salah, and that was probably a disservice to Mane because people are looking at his scoring stats at the moment and he's not scoring, but I thought he was really good against Tottenham the other day, and him and Robertson work so well down the left-hand side. When Liverpool are playing with that midfield three of Fabinho, Henderson and Thiago, and then obviously the front three at the moment obviously has been Jota instead of Firmino. Firmino's now back from injury. And it's whether it's Van Dijk plus Konate or Van Dijk plus Matip, yeah, I think if Liverpool were able to keep that 11 fit, they'd push City all the way. But we saw what happened the other day, and this is what could happen with COVID. Now Liverpool were missing players the other day. Maybe those players come back, and then City suffer the same problem where they're missing a few players. But City's squad, I think, has always been better. I think Liverpool's depth, a lot of people thought they don't have it, but it's probably a lot better than people give it credit for. But I have definitely been impressed with Konate. People were critical of him for the Harry Kane goal the other day, but there was a few things that happened beforehand. I thought maybe if Robertson had stepped Harry Kane's offside, but I think Konate has settled in very well. Like, for a guy that is adapting to a new league, and I think it said it all about him the day Klopp put him in at Old Trafford. Said,
I was thinking that.
You're ready.
Yeah,
and you think back to even when there was the little scuffle with the players and he just ragdolled a few of the United players. His strength is unbelievable. Even watching him in that game at the San Siro, where his strength is unbelievable, his recovery pace. But actually what's very underrated is, because maybe he doesn't look as fluid on the ball as somebody like Van Dijk, but his distribution's actually very good.
Yeah,
and he always looks forward.
It also gives that depth that just wasn't there last year, whether it was going to be Kabak or whoever else was coming in. Liverpool now look, they're going to be without Van Dijk for a few more days as he recovers from COVID-19, then he'll come directly back into the team. But with the injury profile of some of those defenders as well, Phil, finally they've got a little bit of cover. I was surprised to see Joel Matip might be going to the African Cup of Nations if it takes place with Cameroon.
No.
I don't think it's going to happen.
Now, Klopp was asked about it last week and he said it's not happening. Like, it was a nice one. See, the thing is, if you put Liverpool into a story, people will be interested. Same with Manchester United. It gets the readers' attention. So, he's not coming back. I actually, watching that game the other day, I was cursing Joel Matip for passing. When he went on the run, I thought, have a shot. I know it's his left foot, but you're up there. Why not have a shot? He passed it off them.
That's why you miss from old football. That's a great example, right? That would be a shot back in the day where there's not enough tactical instruction from the manager. So it was like, just go, just hit it, son. Just have a go. But nowadays, it's, you know, statistically, that's poor Matip. So he has to pass the ball. He has to keep possession. there's an encapsulation of the difference in football in 20 years.
There you go. Football's too conservative. They care about XG and they care about all the stats that go after the game. Phil, we've got Arsenal action tonight. League Cup, they're up against Sunderland. They'll be expected to come through in this one. Arsenal are in decent form. Look, at this stage, I'm not sure how missed Aubameyang will be from the team anyway. But with the way that Odegaard has been playing, Maitland-Niles and a few of the other young players in recent weeks, they've just seemed to have stumbled upon a system and a reasonable amount of form, with the exception of that game at Anfield, obviously, aside.
Yeah, they've been disappointing, though, away from home. They've a really good home record, Arsenal, and you'd expect them to win tonight. He'll obviously make changes, but, you know, if he brings in players like Nketiah, Smith Rowe hasn't been starting. He did try and fit Smith Rowe and Martinelli Odegaard into the same 11, but he's now gone with Odegaard. But Smith Rowe comes in and he scores goals. I think he's a cracking player. Their one problem really for me is the midfield. It's still like Thomas Partey's been desperate for them. Like he rated his time as a 4 out of 10. Since he moved, and that was probably being generous. Now he can get better. Xhaka, saw again the other day, he had his little moment where he could have seen red, but he got away with it. But if you want to build, Granit Xhaka's not the answer. You can see with Arsenal, they're quite well coached, but as soon as you really get stuck into them, you look at the game at Old Trafford, you look at the game at Goodison Park, obviously the game at Anfield, I still would worry about them away from home. And I think that's what really disappointed a lot of Leeds fans, that they had Elland Road absolutely bouncing the other night and they didn't lay a glove on Arsenal. Arsenal actually have Manchester City on the 1st of January at the Emirates. It's an early game. That's a fixture that hasn't been kind to Arsenal recently.
To say the least, yeah.
But that would be an interesting one to see how they get on that one. Obviously, Arteta going up against Pep Guardiola, he got one over him in the FA Cup there a couple of seasons ago, a game that was behind closed doors. But look, they're moving in the right direction. I still think United are going to come in and get that top four spot when they actually start playing again.
There you go. Guaranteed. Phil Egan says Arsenal won't be in the top four. That's our takeaways. We reached the halfway point of the season. Thanks to Phil and also to Colin on the show this morning. Here's what we've got coming up on OTB Sports Radio for the rest of today. OTB Goal at 1 p.m. Keith Andrews and Philly McMahon, their sit-down chat. At 3 p.m. it is Dadcast. 4 p.m. a career retrospective with Paddy Bonner. And OTB Goal at 6 p.m. is Cora Staunton ahead of OTB Tonight.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.